I'm Doug Nadvornik. Today on the Inland Journal podcast, we'll hear from the second of two candidates in the race for Spokane City Council in the South District. We heard on Thursday from the challenger, Tony Keepy, and today we talk with the incumbent, Lori Kinnear. She was first elected in 2015 and is now running for a second term. Kinnear is a former broadcast journalist who also worked in advertising and public relations. She also served as an aide to former City Councilwoman Amber Waldrop before running for office herself.
I started with the mayor about the budget and priorities that are getting greater weight this year than it have gotten. As you look at the budget, what should it include that maybe the mayor doesn't include, or do you like all most of the priorities that he's got in there?
I think we're on a synchronized path regarding the budget. What I'm taking a closer look at, though, are the jobs that are vacant right now. And
within the city, you mean?
Mm-hmm. Yes. What are those jobs? Why are they vacant? Why have they been vacant for a year? If they're vacant, do we really need them? I want to take a close look at all those exempt confidential positions and say, okay, is there a better way to use these funds? Maybe put more money towards public safety, more planners, more code enforcement. We're having a tough time keeping people in code enforcement and having enough people. So when your wait time is 3, 4, 5 weeks after you make a complaint, I think we have to take a look at that and say, these are people's priorities. Now let's fund those positions so there's not that 5 week wait.
Why do you think they're having problems keeping code enforcement people?
Part of it is temporary, seasonal, or part-time, and it's a robust job market right now, so you have to be competitive, and people want full-time work, or the ones that don't want full-time work, code enforcement's hard. So if I'm going to be working in code enforcement, I want full-time, I want benefits, I want, health insurance, all those things to compensate me for the hard work.
So the mayor's budget, I think, has a $3.5 million deficit, if we read right. What do you need to do in order to get that to balance by the end of the year?
And so he's looking at it, his team is looking at it right now to find ways to get it balanced. And I think they'll find those. We go through this every year. So I've been here 10 years. This happens every year. And so you look at, okay, I'm 3.5 over. Okay, let's cut this, this, and this. And then, poof, it's good.
Do you worry about when the economy does slow down and you get back to those years where you've got $8-10 million to cut and there's all this angst about how are we going to do that?
We've been putting money in reserves, anticipating that. And so when we're up to a healthy reserve, then we don't have to worry. We don't have to lay people off. And that's why it's prudent to have those reserves. And I think we're all on council very fiscally conservative. We want to make sure we have enough money in that rainy day fund that we don't have to worry about that.
So let's go to homelessness. Where is the city in regard to having a shelter? And do you believe the city should be in the shelter business in terms of either owning a shelter or operating a shelter?
Yeah. And we're still waiting right now for a shelter location. We do have a provider selected. However, a provider without a shelter is not going to do us much good. I don't know that we should or should not be in the shelter business, but we find ourselves in that position. And I think a lot of communities across the country are in that position that they weren't in maybe 5 years ago. If you have a housing crisis, what is your responsibility to your constituents to make sure they're safe, they're housed? And a shelter is just one stop in toward permanent housing. We aren't necessarily in the housing business, nor should we be, but we can fund others that will get us to that goal, to get us the housing that we need. And we are in a housing crisis as well. So rents are very high, housing prices are high, we don't have enough housing, and one of the consequences is people are going to be on the street.
So I'll jump into the permanent housing thing, come back to the temporary. Council President Stuckert has proposed a housing trust fund so that I assume it's kind of like an endowment where you've got money that you can draw upon every year in order to, and I would assume that is for the lowest income sorts of housing. Do you support that idea?
I do, and it's not us in the housing business. It's us supporting those who would build housing And when you think about the term affordable, I prefer to call it workforce housing, one-third of your income, no more than one-third of your income, should be devoted to housing and the cost of housing. After that, you are rent burdened or mortgage burdened, or they used to say house poor. You've got the house, but you could have barely afford to stay there. We have to change that. We have to flip that so that people can work one job and still be confident that they're going to be housed. And right now, people are working two and three jobs and still struggling, and that's not okay. So the workforce housing, to me, is important as part of the entire package, as the formula for people to stay stable. Once people are stable and families are stable, then they can prosper. Without that, they can't.
Well, some are pushing the idea that the only way that you can build that housing that's low enough, $120,000, is you got to have more land to build. Would you support the county loosening the urban growth boundary?
No, we don't. If you look at our comprehensive plan, it is very clear, and that, as you know, is our blueprint for how we move forward as a city. Hundreds of people committed thousands of hours to drafting the comprehensive plan. We just updated it in 2017. The council did, or the planning staff, council approved it, mayor signed off on it. So we're all in this together, comprehensive plan. It specifically states that you put your density and your growth in your centers and corridors where there are services, where there is transit, where there is infrastructure. To build further out increases the strain on our infrastructure, our roads. It makes it more difficult for people to access services. They have to have a car. And it's more expensive for the people, the taxpayers, currently. It's not a plan. That is not a plan.
But is there enough of that land that you can convince building developers to buy little lots that are in those areas to be able to build the housing?
Absolutely. If you look at North Monroe, if you look at East Sprague, if you look at Hilliard, Market Street, look up. And those buildings, the ones that should come down, you could put three, four, five stories there. And we're working right now on sub-area plans for North Monroe, for South Perry, and around the Northtown Mall for just that purpose. So how do we increase our density? And the other piece too is, if you go back 100 years, that's how people used to live. They used to center their growth around their centers and corridors. So it's not a new concept, but it's a very efficient concept. And it has the least impact on our neighborhoods, which I think is important. I think people move to the neighborhoods, they expect a certain level of certainty. When you buy a home, you don't want a five-story apartment building going up next to it. So this way, directing your growth into a center and corridor is saying, you homeowner, this is our contract with you. We're not going to impact your neighborhood the way it would if we didn't go with this plan.
You still think there's enough? Because I think that developers would come and say that land in those lots is not cheap enough for me able to build in order for me able to build that I can make a profit and I can keep the prices low enough for people to buy.
And that's why we have incentives. So if you look at the impact fees that we just passed, we incentivize those builders who want to build in centers and corridors. And there's an incentive if you want to restore a historic building for 10 years of property tax abatement. So there are incentives out there that they can take advantage of. If you're over $5 million, you get money back for being a project of significance in the city. So to say that, oh, I can't make it pencil out, you can. You absolutely can. You have to take advantage of the incentives, and you have to be creative.
Our guest on today's Inland Journal podcast is Spokane City Councilwoman Lori Kinnear, who's running for re-election.
Okay, so let's go back then to the homeless situation. Are you optimistic that the city will come up with the shelter it needs in order to keep most of those people in a better situation than they were last year?
I think it'll be more than one building, more than one shelter, probably less population, which is a better thing. The more people you concentrate, the more issues you may have. It's just crowding people in one place is just, you know, psychology 101, right? I'm confident that we will come up with a shelter. I think that it will mitigate what people are fearful of, that we'll go into winter and it'll be cold and wet and rainy and snowy and people won't have a place to go. But I think we're very close to getting something now. The anticipation is, the wait is worse than if we just, can we just know what's out there and what you're finding.
Will there be enough there that the city is not going to have to worry, will be able to enforce the sit-lie ordinance, for
that
example?
That is dependent on how many people we have at any given time. So the police and the social workers will have that on their phones. Yes, there's shelter space at X, Y, or Z. But that's kind of the equivalent of being able to read a crystal ball. You won't know that. I mean, we won't know how many people actually need shelter. How many people are going to be homeless in November? Or how many people will be housed in November? So that's hard to know.
So what are your biggest worries when going into another winter and worrying about the homeless situation as compared to last year?
I think there's a sense people are weary of hearing about the problem. Also, I think that people are still conflating homelessness with drug addiction, mental health, and if you just try hard, your life will be better. And for some people, that's just not the case. And some of the people who are on the streets are not addicted. They don't have mental health issues. If you're on the street long enough, I guarantee you, you'll have mental health issues at the end of the time because it's brutal. I think that there's just this weariness amongst the public of, we're tired of hearing about this, just make it go away. And there is no silver magic bullet. We just don't have one. And it's not a Spokane problem. So let's round up our partners and say, come on, we can all do this together. Let's not have it be a Spokane issue, a Spokane funding alone. Let's all jump on and help. And so far, we haven't seen that.
Are you satisfied with the new police officers who are coming in because of the February property tax increase? There are going to be enough officers downtown to take care of the situation in terms of homeless people and sidewalks and that sort of thing?
I think so. We've got 5 additional officers, and I think a couple of a sergeant and a lieutenant, I think. I don't remember. But in addition to that, we're going to have social workers paired with those officers, and not just on a temporary basis where they go, okay, you're going to be with so-and-so tonight, and then tomorrow night you'll be. So they're going to be paired. They'll be able to work together more closely. The officers already know the players downtown, and they know what the issues are. So now we'll be able to bring those social workers in and help further help. So I think the combination between officers and social workers will really help downtown.
So you've had the social workers. You've got 4 pairs with the city cops, 1, I think, with the fire department.
Now we get more. So we're getting more.
Significantly more?
I don't remember the number, but I want to say 4, but I could be lying.
So will it be 24/7, do you think? It's not 24/7 now.
Yeah, I believe it will be 24. I mean, that's the only way it can really work. And the most critical piece is at night, when people get a little bit more desperate. So I think we will have the coverage we need. We also had a situation that was highly unusual with a number of officers out on light duty due to injuries and sickness. And the number was high enough where Chief Meidel said, this has never happened before. And so it drew down the numbers of available officers. So I don't foresee that happening again.
So there's also the point that the city already has enough ordinances for the homeless. They just need to enforce them. Do you believe that? And should the city, should the police officers be tougher on homeless people?
I don't know that it's, again, it's not the homeless people I worry about. It's the criminal behavior. And yes, they need to enforce. However, we still have issues with what do you do after you arrest somebody for a misdemeanor? Okay, take them to jail, and then they're out because there isn't room at the jail. So it's a domino effect. We have to solve our detention facility before we can really solve the criminal behavior, because right now there isn't a consequence. They know they're going to get out, and they did engage in criminal behavior. If we have mental health beds and substance abuse beds where we can put people just to get sober or just to stabilize them, we'll have a better chance of solving some of the problems. But right now we don't have that.
So let's switch to streets. Do you hear as much about streets as we hear our colleagues in the Northeast, the candidates say, that's the number one for us. Streets and property crime are number one. What are the biggest for you in the South?
It's traffic. Interestingly, it's streets, but a different way. People are concerned about traffic speeding through their neighborhood. So traffic calming is a big deal in my district, and some of the unpaved streets. So we have an arterial 44th that is not paved. It's got four or five blocks of dirt. It's an arterial, and it's impeding traffic because people try and find other routes to get to where they need to go. If we had that open and paved, it would relieve some of the stress on the other arterials. So the dirt streets, we're starting to pave those now, so we're doing a couple each year. It's going to take a while, but we've got the money to do that now.
Should the city make it more of a priority to get those streets that are not paved, that are dusty, paved?
It depends, and that's why we have a matrix to look at that. So if it is an arterial, it must be a high priority. If it's a like Hilliard, where you want to incent development for industrial uses, pave the streets. So it just depends on the situation. Not all dirt streets are equal.
So let's go to climate. About 100 feet from here, a few days ago, we're sitting in the Chase Gallery. There was a pretty big climate strike celebration. The council passed an ordinance by 2030, all the city's electricity should be
fossil free.
Yeah. You agree with that?
Yes. And I co-sponsored the first one in 2017, which said that we need to, the 2030 piece again. And the difference between my ordinance and this one is this most recent ordinance said the mayor will appoint a committee to advise council. And the mayor didn't do that. So the council appointed a subcommittee. And we have 22 people on that subcommittee that have been split into groups to concentrate in certain areas. And that's important because they're going to inform council, here's what we think you can do to get to your goal. My urban forestry ordinance is going to get us further to that goal because I have used that same metric, 30% canopy cover by 2030. And that is part of our stormwater system, stormwater mitigation system. It's important for the health of our community. It saves taxpayer dollars. And I think it's important that for our future and our future generations that we don't just assume everything's going to be okay. If we don't do something, it's not going to be okay. And it's up to every one of us. We can't wait for the national level to, or the world community to. Everybody has to work locally.
So I was going to ask that. There are some who say, you know, this is a global issue, and therefore, you know, what's the city council doing, wasting its time on resolutions that are on a global scale?
And it is. It absolutely is a global scale. But all good legislation starts organically, grassroots. If you look at suffrage movement, it didn't start at the national level. It starts at a grassroots with communities. Every good piece of legislation and good laws started in churches and taverns. The Revolutionary War started in a tavern. That's where people just get together and decide we need to do something. And that's the best way, in my opinion, is to galvanize people and get them to work on the problem. Don't wait for your leaders because you're going to be waiting a long time.
There are advocates who have said, you know, we need to plant a lot more trees. I mean, there were communities that were planting like 1 million trees in a year or something like that. Does the city need to be more aggressive than it has been in terms of global climate change?
Certainly the trees, you know, you're talking about trees and trees are no big thing. Yes, trees are. I mean, they have a lot of impact. And I would say that just planting trees isn't enough. The trees have to actually survive and get big enough to mitigate the effects of climate change. So it's not just about planting, it's about getting them to survive. So part of what we're going to do is encourage people to plant trees, certainly, and offer incentives to do so. But at the same time, those trees have to live. And that's going to be the tricky part, to get them to survive. And I think we can do it. We're just going to have to be, education is key, and we're going to have to be persistent.
You're listening to the Inland Journal podcast, and our guest is Lori Kinnear, who's seeking a second term in the Spokane City Council's South District.
So let's go to the idea of police accountability. There's this whole issue of, you know, should our police officers be wearing body cams, and who should be overseeing them? Are you satisfied that the current ombudsman system is working in Spokane?
He needs to have independent oversight, and that's what the voters passed, and that's still not in place. There's still a discrepancy about how he does his job amongst the police guild and ombudsman, and that's part of what we're dealing with when we talk to people who are that voted for that and say, why isn't this? Well, we're waiting for the police guild to say yes, or maybe we go to arbitration, maybe we do something else. But absolutely the ombudsman needs that oversight, that investigative piece, in order for the ordinance to be as it was intended. Body cams, the police like them too, because it is that eye on actually what's happening. It's not he said, she said anymore. It's here, look at the camera. Here, look at the video. That's what actually happened.
Should there be penalties for those officers who don't turn their body cams on or forget about it? Or
I asked one of our majors about that, and they said, it is very rare that that happens, and there is a disciplinary hierarchy. So then at first it's mentioned that you forgot to turn on your camera, you need to be more aware of that. Then the second and third time it happens, then there would be more of a penalty. But you have to take the person at their word that, I'm sorry, I forgot, it won't happen again. Okay, the second time it happens, you know, you already did this, maybe we need some retraining, and then subsequently discipline.
There's still a trust issue, especially among some people of color who believe they can't get a fair shake.
Yeah.
Do you agree with that? Is there some nugget of truth in that?
Yeah. If you look at our jail population, I believe that is so. And we are not a diverse community. And I think it's very difficult to be a minority in Spokane right now because I don't believe you get a complete, and I don't think it's deliberate, but I think we all have innate biases, and police do just as we all do. And so they look at a person of color differently than they would a person who's Caucasian. It takes a lot of training to overcome that. I don't think we're there yet.
Heading in the right direction, though?
I hope so. We haven't had any Fergusons or, knock on wood, or other such incidents. But I see the level of confidence, and our surveys will show the level of confidence in the job our police department is doing is quite high right now. I think it's 77%. You can check that. So I have confidence we're heading in the right direction. We're just not there yet.
So where is Spokane's most pressing racial issues? Where are the little areas that need to be worked on the most?
Certainly incarceration piece, the disparity between racial minorities and being incarcerated, and for some of the crimes that you just think, what? That's ridiculous. Suspended license or whatever. The second thing is just the economy. So jobs and training and the economics of being a racial minority in Spokane. So it's a huge disparity. Until we really work on bringing people up and being successful, we're never going to achieve that balance. And that involves education. It involves what former council member Amber Waldorf is doing right now in Northeast Spokane and working with families to make sure that the whole family is participating and making sure that child is getting an education, going to school, and thriving. And that's, we have to break the cycle at the children.
Okay, I wanted to give you a chance to finish by talking about some of the things about your record that you're most, that people will go and say, okay, we've given you 4 years, what have you accomplished?
Yeah.
So what have you accomplished?
So this is radio,
yep.
I get it, but I brought this folder. It's about 2 inches thick of all the resolutions and ordinances that I've sponsored. And certainly My first one, which was mitigating human trafficking, is very important, shone a light on that for the community, this problem. And then most recently, the historic preservation and demolition ordinance, which made a huge difference for Brown's Addition neighborhood. And going forward, Cliff Cannon and Logan and some of the other neighborhoods that are historic. Also, the camping mitigation piece, so protecting public lands and open spaces from wildfire, illegal fires, tree destruction, vegetation destruction, and illegal camping that helps with our river and helps us going forward to make sure that those areas are protected and safe. And then the urban forestry ordinance update that I'm sponsoring now. I've sponsored so many, I would say dozens of ordinances and resolutions around public safety, certainly helping to reinstate some of the bar patrol downtown, which was taken away. And I just fussed and fussed until we got those back. And they're reinstated.
We'll finish with this. Are you satisfied the police have enough when they need to go take a camping encampment down that they're taking care of the issue so that it's not going to show up five blocks away in, 3 hours?
Yeah, and that's always a possibility, but the police aren't doing it alone anymore. So we instigated a team approach. That means there's a code enforcement person, there's a police officer, and then there's a litter crew that actually dismantle the camp. And we went from 14 days to take down a camp to 5. So it makes it much more difficult for them to relocate when they know that in a couple of days they're going to be moved again.
And yet people complain about, you're throwing our stuff away, you're throwing it all in the dumpster. And
yeah, but they get warning, they get a 48-hour warning. So it's not like we just swoop in and everything goes away. That's not how it works.
But so if I got nowhere to go, what am I going to do with my stuff?
And that is why we cannot mitigate those unless we have shelter space. Go back to Martin versus Boise. And we cannot mitigate those camps unless we have shelter space.
Should the city create storage space for people to put their stuff?
And hopefully the shelter, I'm hopeful that the shelter will have space to do that, because that is a need. You can't just be dumping people's stuff. At the same time, there has to be some kind of mitigation of bad behavior. Whether it's, and I'm not saying it's bad, I'm saying it's dangerous. It's inherently dangerous for you to be out there camping in the winter, and it's dangerous for the people who might be recreating there, or for you who are starting a fire and it gets out of control and burns down a neighborhood. So it's not the best scenario, and we need to make sure that we are on top of that.
Lori Kinnear is a candidate for the Spokane City Council in the South District. She won a three-way August primary with 59% of the vote. Her opponent this time, Tony Keepy, took 23%. Our next two Inland Journal podcasts will feature interviews with two Spokane Valley City Council candidates who are facing off, Tim Hattenberg and Bo Tucker. You can find our candidate interviews at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Go to the Regional News tab and then click on Election 2019. Inland Journal is Spokane Public Radio's public affairs podcast and radio program. You can subscribe to the podcast at Apple Podcasts, NPR One, or Google Play. Send your comments and story ideas to inlandjournal@kpbx.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Doug Nadvornik.